Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. And Max Armstrong will be along in just a few minutes to speak to us about ag commodities. The markets were closed on Friday because of Good Friday. And while Good Friday is not a federal holiday, it is a stock market holiday. And I was looking at a website that tried to explain why that is and didn't really come up with a clear, concrete explanation. Capital.com says that after being closed on Good Friday off and on, 1907 was the final year in which the exchange was open on Good Friday. Despite this long-held tradition, several myths surrounding the market closure exist, such as there is a tradition of closing on Good Friday for Jewish and Christian traders looking for a break between Passover and Easter. The lease of the building housing the stock exchange stipulates that no business can be conducted on Good Friday. This seems largely debunked because the exchange has changed locations since 1907. Another one, Easter is not a federal holiday, but many businesses that operate on Sunday close for the festivities. And since Easter is always on a Sunday, closing up shop on Friday is a good proxy. Good Friday is not a government holiday at the federal level, but many states recognize it as a state holiday. And as a result, many local governments, banks, and other institutions will close on Friday, making a dent in trading volume. And another, perhaps, myth about why we don't trade on Good Friday, markets aren't open in Europe for Good Friday either. American and European holidays are not synced to the same schedule, but closing in times of weak trading demand makes economic sense. And yet another possible explanation for why the markets are closed on Good Friday. 2 or 3 years in a row during the 1890s, there were big drops in the market on Good Friday. Traders took that as a sign from God that he did not want the exchange open. Regardless of what the reason is, the markets were closed on Friday. There was economic news on Friday, though. U.S. retail sales fell for a second straight month in March, and consumer prices dropped for the first time in just over a year, underscoring the magnitude of the loss of economic growth momentum in the first quarter. But with the labor market near full employment, Friday's weak reports failed to change views that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates again in June. Economists expect a rebound in both retail sales and in monthly inflation. Gregory Dacko is head of the U.S. Macroeconomics Unit at Oxford Economics in New York City. He says, for the Fed, the underlying momentum is more important in terms of policy decisions, and that looks to be strong, supported by a tightening labor market, rising incomes, and high consumer confidence. The Commerce Department said retail sales dropped 0.2% last month after a 0.3% decrease in February. That was the first and biggest decline in nearly a year. Compared to March last year, retail sales increased by 5.2%. Economists had expected that retail sales would slip by 0.1%. Excluding automobiles, gasoline, building materials, and food services, retail sales rebounded 0.5% last month after falling 0.2% in February. Despite last month's rebound in core retail sales, consumer spending likely braked sharply in the first quarter after growing at a brisk 3.5% annualized rate in the final 3 months of 2016. The apparent slowdown in consumption is partly blamed on the late payment of income tax refunds by the government as it sought to combat fraud. Retail sales last month were undercut by a 1.2% tumble in receipts at auto dealerships. It was the third straight monthly drop in auto sales. Lower gasoline prices also undermined retail with a 1% drop in receipts at service stations. There were some strong areas in the retail sales numbers. Electronics and appliance store sales recorded their biggest rise since June of 2015. Receipts at clothing stores increased by the most in a year despite declining mall traffic and increased competition from online retailers. In a separate report, the Labor Department said its consumer price index dropped 0.3% in March. That's the first decline in 13 months and biggest decrease since January 2015 amid falling prices for gasoline and mobile phone services, which offset rising rents and food costs. A 6.2% drop in gasoline prices was the biggest factor in that monthly decline in the CPI, which was also weighed down by a record 7% plunge in the cost of wireless telephone services. On Wall Street for the week, the Dow was down 1%, the S&P was down 1.1%, and the NASDAQ was down 1.2%. On Thursday, the major indices fell for a third straight day as investors weighed earnings reports from big banks and geopolitical tensions, while the tech sector fell for a 10th consecutive session. Wells Fargo was one of the big losers on Thursday as its shares fell 3.3%, pulling down the S&P 500 after the bank reported a drop in mortgage banking revenue. Berkshire Hathaway also disclosed late on Wednesday that it had cut its stake in Wells Fargo. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan Chase dropped 1.2% and Citigroup was off nearly 1%, even as those companies reported better-than-expected quarterly profits. But in those reports was more evidence of a slowdown in the growth of loans. Throughout the week, investors looked for safe haven assets due to geopolitical tensions in Syria and North Korea. News of a massive bomb being dropped by the U.S. in eastern Afghanistan on Thursday added to uncertainty. Kate Warren, principal investment strategist at Edward Jones in St. Louis, said what we're seeing is investors from the rest of the world putting more money in U.S. treasuries due to geopolitical concerns, and a dip in bond yields put pressure on stocks. The Dow fell 139 points on Thursday to 20,453. The S&P lost 16 points to 2328, and the NASDAQ was down 31 points at 5805. The benchmark S&P 500 has climbed 8.9% since the November 8th election, supported by Trump's planned economic agenda of tax cuts and economic stimulus. But the rally has stalled over the last 6 weeks, as some investors are questioning the president's ability to come through on his campaign promises. Paul Nolte is portfolio manager of Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago. He said there is some concern among investors that there is now a shift going on in Washington to international and away from a domestic policy. Financials have had a rocky run. The S&P 500 Financial Index dropped 1.3%, the fifth straight day of losses. Energy shares were the worst performing group, falling 1.8%, and the tech sector fell 0.4%, marking its longest losing streak since May of 2012. Crude oil prices were little changed in modest volume on Thursday, but it was a good week for crude. Benchmark Brent crude futures settled 3 cents higher to $55.89 a barrel after touching a one-month high on Wednesday. West Texas Intermediate crude, Texas T, settled 7 cents higher at $53.18 a barrel. Both benchmarks were set for a third consecutive weekly gain. Gold prices eased from five-month highs on Thursday as the dollar rebounded from a slide triggered by comments from President Trump that the greenback was too strong and that he would prefer the Federal Reserve keep interest rates low. The metal was up about 2.6% on the week, on track for its biggest weekly gain since June. The president's comments about the dollar and also about the Fed and Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen brought commentary from Peter Schiff of Euro-Pacific Capital. He spoke on CNBC with Courtney Reagan.
Well, the dollar and yields on the move today after President Trump called the greenback overvalued and said he'd like to keep interest rates low. That's actually a far cry from the comments he made on the campaign trail, for those of you keeping track, where Trump blamed the Fed for inflating the stock market and said he would fire the Fed chair, Janet Yellen. For more, let's bring in Peter Schiff of Euro-Pacific Capital. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. I guess, first of all, what's your take on what Trump had to say to the Wall Street Journal about the dollar?
Well, I believe he's correct. The dollar is overvalued, but he's wrong in his view about how the overvalued dollar impacts the U.S. economy, at least, you know, in the short run. And because the dollar is overvalued, we have an artificially high standard of living. And I think that when the dollar does decline, it's going to take the U.S. standard of living down with it.
But then he said that the dollar being strong is really just better for optics. It really actually can be harmful when the dollar is too strong. What do you make of those comments?
Well, I think over the long run, having an artificially high dollar that encourages excess consumption and discourages capital investment and undermines the long-term competitiveness of our businesses is true. You know, we want a dollar to be valued based on the fundamentals, and the fundamentals for the U.S. are lousy. The dollar should be a lot lower, but because it's the reserve currency and because a lot of speculators buy the dollar is higher than it should be, and so Americans get to enjoy a standard of living, at least temporarily, that's out of whack with their actual productivity. And so, you know, this is another example of be careful what you wish for, because when the dollar goes down, our problems are going to exacerbate. And, you know, Donald Trump thinks that a weaker dollar is the key to turning around our trade deficit. It's not. Look at how weak the dollar was under George Bush. The dollar had a tremendous decline under George Bush from 2001 to 2008. Yet the highest trade deficits during the Bush presidency were in 2007, 2008, when the dollar was at its lowest level. And by the way, these trade deficits, in the long run, they're terrible for us because we're spending ourselves into bankruptcy because we're borrowing to consume. But in the short run, we benefit because we get to enjoy greater consumption than our productivity would allow. It's our foreign trading partners that are subsidizing this. So, you know, Trump doesn't really understand this. And by the way, you know, his comments on Janet Yellen, you know, it seems like neither Obamacare nor Janet Yellen are going to be replaced. And now that we're dropping bombs in the Middle East, to me, it looks like business as usual there in the swamp. And all the people who were buying into U.S. stocks because they thought something was going to change and that Trump was going to make America great again, better take a look at what's actually happening and separate that from the campaign rhetoric.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I just want to make sure, in case our viewers and listeners hadn't had a chance to read that article, that when asked if Janet Yellen was toast, Trump said, no, she's not toast, suggesting maybe actually he likes some of her low interest rate policy. I mean, do you, Peter, want to see Janet Yellen and her policies continue? What are you hoping for out of Yellen and the Fed?
Well, as an American, I'd like to see her replaced because she's a disaster for the country. She's completely incompetent. But Donald Trump is a low interest rate guy. I mean, he said that when he campaigned. And, you know, he wants Janet Yellen to stay, I think, as Fed chairman. He wants to dangle this carrot in front of her that, hey, you know, you could stay on if you play ball. And what play ball means is, you know, back away from these rate hikes. And, you know, by the way, you know, when the month of February began, the Atlanta Fed was looking for 3.4% GDP growth in the first quarter. Now they're just looking for 0.6. We actually might get negative GDP growth in the first quarter. Yet despite this, the Fed is still posturing as if they're going to raise interest rates. And I think Donald Trump would like to change that posturing to try to blow some air back into this bubble, which now he has basically, named for himself. Because when he was a candidate, he was very critical of the big, fat, ugly bubble. But now that he owns the bubble, he wants to make sure it doesn't pop. And so he wants to get Janet Yellen to play ball. But as an investor, right, what Janet Yellen has done and what she is going to do is going to make me a lot of money. And it's going to make people who have been following my advice a lot of money. I mean, it's already started. Look at the price of gold this year. It's up about 12%. It's up triple what the Dow is. Emerging markets, same story. They're about tripling the gains on the Dow. And this is just the very beginning, because as the air comes out of this bubble and as all the damage that 8 years of 0% or practically 0% interest rates have done to this economy, when Janet Yellen goes back to the drawing board on QE4, right, when she lowers rates and launches an even bigger quantitative easing program than the last three combined, right, the bottom's going to drop out of the dollar, gold's going to take off, and then people are finally going to see the real damage that has been done to this economy with this reckless monetary policy and the damage that was done under Barack Obama. I mean, he did tremendous damage to this economy, but the Federal Reserve covered up a lot of the effects by inflating these massive bubbles, but it didn't fool average Americans. That's why Donald Trump was elected president in the first place. But unfortunately, he's going to have to deal with this mess.
Peter Schiff of Euro-Pacific Capital with Courtney Reagan on CNBC. The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group, continues after this.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need, today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander, in for Orion Samuelson, and our buddy, that rascal Max Armstrong, is here with a special guest.
Brian Basting is here from Advanced Trading. He comes by from time to time, and I'm trying to remember, let's see, the last time you came by here, if we had so much bearish data prior to your visit. Let's see if we can find something friendly here eventually, but it seems like almost everything that comes out, whenever there is something, well, modestly friendly in a report, there's something else to offset it. We did get this week a supply-demand report.
We did get a supply-demand report, Max. That report did show larger crops in South America for corn and soybeans, specifically in Brazil and Argentina. Now, that's been known by the market for a while now. I don't think that's necessarily fresh news. So I think the market had been anticipating those bigger crops, and I think that, the USDA just confirmed those bigger crops. Now, I would remind your listeners, though, that we do have a double crop corn in Brazil, Safrinha crop, that is just approaching pollination. That crop is not made yet. So I think remind your listeners last year that we did have a drought. It did cut back that crop quite a bit. No indication of a drought so far this year, but as your listeners know, we get into pollination, anything can happen.
Also, did this report take into account recent heavy rains in Argentina? There have been some rather significant rains there, and we know, I mean, we're thinking about what happened a year ago when they had the crop in the field and some very late damage occurred because of flooding rains.
That's an important point because the USDA actually increased their production estimates for both Argentina corn by 1 million tons and Argentina beans by 500,000 tons from last month. Now, the harvest of both those crops is not far along. We've got probably 80% of the corn harvest yet to go, probably closer to 90% of the bean harvest. As you mentioned, last year we did have an issue with flooding that really scaled back that Argentina bean crop. So yes, it's something we want to keep an eye on. Apparently, USDA indicated that is not a major issue so far, but we really want to keep a close eye on that the next 30 days.
From the standpoint of demand, that still isn't bad, is it? We're tallying up some rather significant export shipments still.
A very important point you make, Max, because even though they increased the size of the Brazilian corn crop 2 million tons, Argentina corn crop 1 million tons, they left the U.S. export forecast unchanged from last month. Now, the impact, the full impact of those Argentina and Brazil crops may not be felt until new crop, but still, at least for the next 3 to 6 months, it looks like corn export demand is very strong, and we're still seeing strong export demand for beans, given the time of year we are here in mid-April.
Has China totally switched over yet from the United States to South American origin?
Not quite yet. They still have a fair amount of unshipped export sales on the books. Now, they could end up canceling those.
They've been known to do that, haven't they?
Occasionally that has happened in the past, but and there's even a chance they could roll those into new crop. But at this point, they continue to give every indication of lifting those sales they've got on the books. So it looks like, I would say our soybean export program could remain a bit stronger than what we think, at least into the next month or so.
Obviously, USDA is assuming big production in the United States as they put these numbers together this week. Was there anything in that set of data that you found significant?
Really, we won't get any update on the 17 crop until May. So USDA is looking at updates for South America and Europe and so forth for old crop. But the first estimates really for new crop won't be reflected until next month.
And that'll be based, of course, on planting intentions, not actual planting numbers, because we won't have those at that point. Those won't come along until June.
Historically, USDA utilizes the planting intentions report. Then they'll take a look at planting progress up until that early May time period to gauge a trend yield. If the planting progress is very rapid, sometimes they'll tweak up their trend yield from what it was at the Ag Outlook form. A lot of times they'll just leave it unchanged from what it was in the Ag Outlook form.
We did see some planting progress. We saw some numbers of very modest progress. Actually, it's just about on par with a year ago and on average, isn't it?
It is. I think the key time period now, as your listeners know, will be this last 2 weeks in April. All the short-term forecasts, or I should say the majority of the short-term forecasts, do have rain moving in here, quite a bit of rain next week. And if those rains are realized, that's the point where planting progress for corn will fall behind the normal rate. What we've seen, though, in the past, and as you know, Max, and as your listeners know, with the size of the equipment your producers have today, we can sure knock out a lot of acres in a short period of time, given a dry window.
The Southern Corn Belt, I was sensing, could get some work done here going through Easter weekend, perhaps. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think that the further south you go, even in southern Illinois, southern Indiana, and a bit further to the east, maybe is not going to see the rain until later in the weekend. So if conditions are permitting to get some work done, we could see a bit. I would just hasten to say that, again, with the size of the equipment we have today, I would remind your listeners that we need to only go back a couple years of 2013. We knocked out 60% of the nationwide corn acreage in just 2 weeks' time, and I certainly think we could do that again this year.
I was going to say, when weather cooperates, you can get close to a half, probably maybe 40% or so in a week, can't you?
Yeah, I would think that was 4 years ago when we had that done. I would think you're spot on. I would think we could do at least a third, if not 40% in 1 week. And who knows, we may set the bar even higher if it was the ideal weather.
Well, one thing that occurs to me is farmers did get some field work done in the days of February. As weather permitted, there were folks out there working the fields and trying to get a head start on this season. I don't think anybody planted, or I didn't hear of any significant planting. We did see some of that social media video or still photos, and I think some of those folks were toying with us a little bit. But one thing that you do see, that you do observe watching the social media, Facebook postings and Twitter, these guys are ready to go.
Certainly. I think everyone is motivated now. Everyone realizes that, as the window opens, you want to be prepared. And today's producer realizes that that window can be narrow at times, so you really have to take advantage. So, yes, there's no question the producers are prepared and ready to go.
Now, I guess I'm thinking of the 3I League at Ohio and Nebraska as I talk about that. But as you look at the northern part of this expanded Corn Belt, you look into the Dakotas and Minnesota, what's the status there?
That is probably one of the better places right now in terms of lack of moisture or not excess moisture. So those producers up there could get an opportunity to get going here quickly. A very good point. When you look at that northwest Corn Belt, you look at Minnesota, you look at the Dakotas, a substantial amount of acres could get put in on time up in that area, if not a bit early.
Well, how bearish would a rapid planting progress be? I ask that question because so many times in recent months, with this robust export demand, even when something that occurred that appeared to be totally bearish, it didn't have quite the market reaction. I mean, is it the fact that the prices are so low already that when you get something like this, it's hard to really unsettle the market?
I do think it's a combination of two things. One that you just hit on is that the market is already discounted to some degree, with December corn, new crop corn up below $4 a bushel, and new crop soybeans now below $10 a bushel, that there has been some discount in there in anticipation of record or production, particularly for beans, and another good crop for corn. The second thing is demand. I think anytime you look at how strong the world demand is today for both oil seeds and for coarse grains, we need to have a very large crop here in the U.S. on top of the large crops that we're currently seeing being harvested in South America. If there's a hiccup in either of those areas, then the market is on edge at these lower prices. So that's keeping at least some type of weather premium in the market.
What about the possibility of a planting time rally? Obviously, it would seem to be difficult to do that if the planting is going at a normal pace or even faster than normal. But if you get some of these rain delays, could that bring a price spike in your mind?
It could. I would caution your listeners to remember that, again, that the planting delay is much less sensitive, much less volatile than a pollination, hot weather type of scare delay. Having said that, you know, we definitely do need to get this corn in particular in a timely fashion, planted in a timely fashion. We certainly don't want to see corn planting past the second week of April or second week of May. But I think at this point, those type of rallies should be viewed as opportunities for your listeners to really consider some marketing strategies to put a floor underneath themselves and leave the upside open.
Are we a few weeks away yet from really watching July weather closely, July and August? Do we have to get this crop planted first before the focus really shifts to summertime weather, pollination weather, for example?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the market is looking at first things first. Let's see how this planting season goes. Let's see how quick it goes in. And then definitely, once you get past, I would say Memorial Day, once we know one way or another if we planted as many corn acres as we thought or perhaps a few more bean acres than what we thought earlier, then the market's full attention is on the pollination weather and that summer weather for corn and beans.
Brian, thank you. Brian Basting, Advanced Trading, we appreciate it.
Always good to be with you, Max.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, It's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. Let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade on Thursday, the final day of trading before the long weekend. Corn futures closed higher on technical buying and short covering ahead of the three-day weekend, and worries also about a slow start to planting in the Midwest. May corn settled 2 cents higher at 3.71 a bushel. The added concern about slow planting is because of rain showers in the forecast across the western half of the Corn Belt next week, which are likely to stall farmers as they try to plant corn and soybeans. Commodity funds hold a large net short position in corn futures, leaving the market prone to bouts of short covering. There were some rallies over the week, but they were capped by expectations of a big South American corn harvest and also disappointing weekly U.S. export sales. The USDA reported weekly export sales of old crop U.S. corn at 738,000 tons and new crop sales at 50,000 tons, both below the trade expectations. Markets closed on Friday at the Chicago Board of Trade. They will reopen for trading Sunday night at 7 o'clock. Soybean futures at the Chicago Board of Trade rose on Thursday on bargain buying after this week's dip to one-year lows. May beans settled 7.75 cents higher to 9.55 and a half. The contract fell to 9.29 and three quarters on Tuesday, the lowest it had been in a year. May soy meal rose $4.80 to $317.50 per short ton. That was helped out by commercial buying after the contract fell to six-month lows this week as well. And May soy oil ended down 0.05 cent at 31.19 cents per pound, losing ground to soy meal on meal and oil spreads. Ahead of monthly soy crushing data due on Monday from the National Oilseed Producers Association, analysts surveyed by Reuters expected that the trade group will report that its members crushed 156.7 million bushels of beans in March. The USDA reported weekly export sales of old crop U.S. beans at 402,200 tons at the low end of trade expectations, and new crop sales at 124,700 tons, also below expectations. Wheat futures at the Chicago Board of Trade fell on Thursday on forecasts for beneficial rains in the Plains winter wheat belt, and also as traders squared positions ahead of the three-day weekend. May wheat settled down 3.5 cents at 4.29 and three quarters a bushel. Kansas City May hard red winter wheat settled down 2 3/4 cents at 4.27 and a quarter a bushel. And the Magic's May spring wheat closed up 1.5 cents at 5.30 and a quarter per bushel. Before we wrap it up for today, some odds and ends. Remember when Sears was where America shops? That was the ad slogan anyway. Those days are long gone. Sears, of course, is struggling. And when it comes to where Americans like to shop, one thing is very clear. They are after value. According to new data from the NPD Group's checkout tracking service, the largest percentage of Americans spent money at Walmart, McDonald's, and Target last year. 95% of American consumers shopped at one of Walmart's stores or on its website last year. It was followed by McDonald's at 89% and Target at 84%, and all of that means that more than 5 in 6 U.S. shoppers made a purchase at one of those chains. Among retailers, Dollar Tree recorded the biggest gains from 2015. It opened nearly 600 stores under that name last year. And Chick-fil-A, which is also in expansion mode, was the biggest gainer between 2015 and 2016 among restaurant sales. And despite all we hear about online shopping, Amazon barely squeaked into the top 20. The NPD survey shows that 42% of consumers spent money on Amazon. Thursday was a big day for a company called Yext, Y-E-X-T. It had its first day of trading after its IPO, and Yext finished the day 22% higher at $13.41 per share. Yext is an internet technology company that provides a platform which enables businesses to manage their listings and company information on multiple sites. Yext was founded in 2006 and is based in New York City. And as of its IPO, it had 630 employees. Yext, Y-E-X-T, that's the trading symbol as well. That'll wrap it up for the markets for the week of April 10th, 2017, sponsored by the CME Group. In for Orion Samuelson, and with Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.